A U of I professor who faced accusations of sexual harassment was set to return to teaching last month. Now, a new report is out with more claims against him from 15 women. We'll get the latest on the years-long case sparked by the Me Too movement. And whenever it rains in a town near East St. Louis, Illinois, wastewater floods into people's yards and homes. Residents are concerned about their health and say public officials are doing little to help. Plus, we'll talk about efforts to preserve Black history in Springfield and ask what else needs to be done.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Mary Hansen. Coming up later this hour, whenever it rains in Centerville, Illinois, wastewater floods residents' homes and yards. We'll speak with a longtime resident of the town. And Springfield's history goes well beyond just Abraham Lincoln. Today, we'll talk about some of the efforts to preserve the city's Black history and ask what else historian Catherine Harris would like to see recognized. But first, in the fall of 2018, sexual harassment allegations came to light against University of Illinois law professor Jay Kaysen. It turns out there had been years of complaints against him from women who said they experienced unwanted advances, touching, and comments from the tenured faculty member. The university determined his behavior was inappropriate and unethical, but that it did not rise to the level of a violation of the university's sexual misconduct policy. That decision drew criticism, and some faculty members said the bar for what qualifies as sexual harassment was set too high. But now a new report with more claims against Kaysen from 15 women finds that he did violate the school's sexual harassment policy. This prompted the dean of the law school to call for, quote, serious sanctions up to and including dismissal, end quote. For more on the latest in this investigation, we're joined by Rachel Otwell, a reporter for the Illinois Times. She reported on sexual harassment at Illinois universities for NPR Illinois and ProPublica's local reporting network. Also joining us is Kathy Lee. She's a resident of Urbana with friends at the law school who experienced harassment. Rachel, Kathy, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Rachel, before we get into the new details of the case, let's recap how this all began. In October of 2018, there was a complaint against Jay Kaysen, a law professor at the U of I. What did that allege?
Well, if we start at the very beginning in terms of what's known publicly, I think we have to start at a Me Too forum that was held at the College of Law in October 2018. That the point of it was to talk about Me Too in academia. And most people were none the wiser to the fact that Jay Kaysen, a law professor there, had been through his own investigation after three women alleged sexual harassment on his part. The investigation ended up finding that he had violated a code of conduct, but not the sexual harassment policy. There had also been 38 witnesses as part of that investigation. And so those who knew about it but knew that the university was not addressing anything publicly had concerns about what this meant going forward. He's teaching in a regular capacity. Students who, you know, maybe they have a past with sexual violence. Maybe they would make a decision about what classes to enroll for differently, knowing this past behavior. Those were the kinds of concerns that I think people had going into that forum. And then having Kathy Lee here today is wonderful, because without her, I don't think any of this reporting would have been done, because reporters were in the same boat of being none the wiser.
Exactly.
So
Kathy, as Rachel mentioned, you were the one who brought this up at a Me Too forum in 2018. You spoke about what some of your friends had experienced at the law school. What made you want to come forward in that moment?
Oh, thanks for the question. Well, when I saw that there was this forum about Me Too in academia, it just seemed so ironic that there would be a forum at the law school, which sort of gave the impression that they were participating in the Me Too movement, whereas I knew behind the scenes they were actually experiencing a Me Too situation in their own environment, and students and other faculty were not aware of the situation. So I came forward because I wanted to speak out on my friend's behalf and just make sure that everyone in that community was aware that this investigation had gone on and that the university seemed to have done its best to keep everything very quiet under the guise of, this is a confidential issue, this is about personnel, we can't share this information. And I've heard that many times before in situations like this. And I think that kind of privacy and secrecy allows victims to come forward and have nothing positive come out of their experience. So my motivation was really to try to protect other students, faculty, and other people who were interacting with Kaysen, because it just seemed like there was potential for this to continue.
And so, Rachel, as this investigation came to light and was discussed, why was the university criticized over its handling of these investigations?
So as we mentioned, the university report that was subsequently uncovered by media because of what Kathy Lee brought to light detailed the allegations of harassment from three women. And then also a letter was found by reporters who had requested records. I think this one originated from his personnel file, but a letter from all the way back to 2002 showing that there was a history here of unwanted sexual behavior that the people in charge were privy to, and that Kaysen had repeatedly been given advice on how to behave in a more professional manner. And so after the report that was finalized in 2017 was made public, there were calls from student groups, the student Bar Association, for one, saying that Kaysen should resign. And he wrote a letter to the law community largely admitting to the behavior and apologizing for the conduct as described by victims, and said he would take a voluntary unpaid leave for the calendar year of 2019. And so the criticism was that, you know, while he might be voluntarily going through this process, why were there not more severe sanctions in the first place? And to get more severe sanctions, his behavior would have had to qualify as sexual misconduct. I've heard from faculty in the law community to reach that level, you have to hit a standard of severe or pervasive conduct, and that level, as defined by case law, current case law, is too high for a majority of behavior that people on a common sense basis would qualify as sexual harassment. If you touch someone in a private area just once, according to case law, that might not be severe or pervasive. Meanwhile, in an academic setting, if a professor is engaging in that behavior with multiple women, many would argue that that should qualify as sexual harassment. And I'm going to get a little weedy here for just a second, but I want to point out in the new investigations I've uncovered that I know we're going to get to, the lawyer who investigated for the university kind of made that point himself. He said, while considering whether sexual harassment or not has been taking place, there are very demanding standards established by case law. Those are his words. And then I'll continue to quote him real quick. This sexual harassment standard closely parallels the standard that would apply in a civil damages action against the university for sexual harassment. Thus, if the university could act only in cases where the actor's conduct satisfied this standard, it would be powerless to intervene until the actor's conduct had exposed the university to civil liability, which is why in the first case, it was important to note that he still did violate a policy, but it was the code of conduct, not the sexual harassment policy. And so if they are going to broaden, if the university could decide to broaden what it considers sexual harassment, that's really what's going on right now in terms of what people are asking for. That's part of it.
And so, Kathy, were you satisfied? Rachel sort of walked us through the pieces of both investigations. Were you satisfied with the university's response after you came forward in 2018?
You know, I really wasn't, and I have to say that my friends weren't either. And It's not to say that some things didn't happen. I was really happy to see that students at the law school came forward and they sort of took this on as something that they cared about and made some noise about. But it didn't feel like any meaningful change happened from that. There has been they put together a committee that studied the sexual harassment policies at the U of I, and they've put forward a report that says, we think these changes should be made. But until those policies are actually adopted, nothing has actually changed. It looks like the university's done something good, and they have. But until policy changes, it really doesn't benefit a student at all.
And so, Rachel, just briefly, I know Kathy mentioned what the changes are. What are some of the changes that the University of Illinois committee recommended?
So there's a number of different committees. I'll focus on the UIUC Faculty Sexual Misconduct Committee that came directly in the wake of the situation with Kaysen, and they were tasked with looking at best practices and coming up with suggestions for changes to policies, and they released those last year. Some of the recommendations include things like expanding the definition of sexual harassment beyond the campus's current standard, like I just kind of mentioned why, and hiring more advisors and investigators. So the advisors would be hiring more people who can work with victims as advisors, as confidential advisors outside of the university's investigative process, as well as hiring more investigators within the university's Title IX office. And then also a suggestion about asking candidates for university jobs to waive confidentiality and reveal their disciplinary records. And some of these recommendations were also suggested by, as I mentioned, there's a number of committees. There's a university system-wide committee that considered what the faculty sexual misconduct put together. And they also brought to the Board of Trustees some of these suggestions, including tracking and disclosing findings of misconduct on a need-to-know basis. And then last November, the Board of Trustees voted in support of system-wide recommendations. In terms of implementation, though, These are piecemeal suggestions. It's not something that everything can be taken at once and passed with a single vote. From what I know, broad implementation has not yet happened. And in the very latest that I heard from Robin Carr, who heads the Faculty Sexual Misconduct Committee, he says the provost's office has created an implementation team, is still soliciting input from stakeholders, and the recommendations are being broken down into buckets. Then there are some changes like creating budget lines for more of these confidential advisors that he says have already begun.
So there's movement on implementation, it sounds like, beginning. But getting back to the J. Kaysen investigations, it looks like there's new information that has come to light. He was slated to return to the university to teach in January. Law students found out in December that wasn't happening. He was going on administrative leave. And now there's the new investigation, Rachel, that you received through public records request, and the letter from the law school dean that said that he recommends that Kaysen be dismissed. That stricter action should be taken against him. What has changed in that case?
So the most recent investigations include details from as many as 14 people is how they qualified it. Well, that's one report. It's broken into one report. One has 14 people's allegation, and those allegations date back over a period as long as 15 years. And then there's a separate report that details a series of actions in 2014 of a sexual or gender-based nature regarding a single former student. And so in that one, there were allegations of inappropriate touching, repeated attempts to get this person one-on-one in situations that were not for professional matters. And the investigator himself said that the touching bordered on sexual assault and found that Kaysen had violated both the code of conduct as well as the sexual misconduct policy in those cases.
And so I want to be sure to get to, I know you've done some reporting on this. How has Kaysen responded to the findings of the report, and what has the university said?
Yeah, so Kaysen overall says there's no evidence that supports many of the findings. And he says he's not been treated fairly by the university. He stands by the statement he made back in November of 2018, where he said he's committed to acting in a manner beyond reproach, and he understands that he needs to be more mindful and self-aware of his actions. He's gone through professional counseling. He says he's about to be punished for a third time now for some of the same basic conduct. And then when I asked, do you know what this means for your future at the U of I, he says, I don't know. And then the university told us that Kaysen's not currently teaching in the law school or anywhere else on campus and is not permitted to be present at the college and has not been allowed there for over a year, and that in lieu of this new investigation and these new findings, the university is initiating the process required for the imposition of severe sanctions up to and including dismissal. There's Article 10 of the university statutes that sets out a process that will have to be gone through for that to take place. So we're still, you know, keep your eyes on the space, as they say. And then Kaysen for now is on unpaid administrative leave, and we know that he his salary is more than $230,000.
Yeah, still a developing situation. But Kathy, in just the minute we have left, what would justice look like to you in these types of situations?
That's a great question, and I would say it's tricky because I don't know that there is such a thing as justice in this scenario. Once a victim has come forward, they lose something they're never going to get back. They lose confidentiality. They lose privacy, credibility with some people, and a lot of opportunities that might have been available to them if they didn't come forward. So I would say the only thing that looks like justice is having something incredibly meaningful come out of it. In this case, I think that would be Jay Kaysen no longer working at this university, and it would mean that the university implemented new code of conduct that really could protect students in a more meaningful way.
And that's all the time we have for now. We've been joined by Rachel Otwell, Illinois Times reporter, and we've also been joined by Kathy Lee, an Urbana resident who's sharing at a Me Too forum inspired this reporting. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, Mary.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Mary Hansen. Centerville, Illinois, about 20 minutes southeast of St. Louis, floods nearly every time it rains. The deteriorating water and sewer system leaves much of the town submerged in 2 to 3 feet of water. Pipes back up, and residents are often exposed to raw sewage, even toilet paper, in their yards and homes. It's a nearly all-black town with an average income of just above $17,000, making it one of the poorest places in the country. And residents there say the city is doing little to help their sewage problem. On the line to talk about this, we have resident Early Fuse, who has lived in Centerville for over 28 years. Also joining us is attorney Nicole Nelson. She's the director and founder of Equity Legal Services, a nonprofit that provides free legal services for low-income people. She and her team have been helping Centerville residents for the last 2 years. We also have Walter Johnson with us. He's a Winthrop professor of history and professor of African and African American studies at Harvard University. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Early, I wanted to start with you. You lived in Centerville for over 28 years. What made you want to move there? Why did you want to move there?
When I was looking for a place of residence, I rode around in different areas, and this area was so beautiful, and no flooding and none of that was going on until 1993. So I moved here February 22nd, 1992.
So it made a good first impression, a beautiful town. And Professor Johnson, like we mentioned, Centerville is one of the poorest towns in the country. You wrote about it for the Boston Review, explaining some of the research you've done. How does a town like Centerville get to this point?
Well, I think that, like a lot of Metro East, the area has been in decline since the 1950s. So up until about 1950, East St. Louis was an industrial suburb of St. Louis. And there was never exceptionally effective municipal governance in the area, but there were jobs, and there was a tax base. But in about 1950, a lot of that industry began to move away to the south and to the southwest and eventually overseas. And so the tax base of the area began to attenuate. Around that time, whites started to move from East St. Louis to places like Centerville, and then gradually black working class people began to move to Centerville. And Centerville increasingly became an all-black town. And between, I think, the decline in the fiscal situation, the decline in infrastructure, and a kind of a general disregard for the suffering of poor black elderly people in our society generally, in the Midwest and in the Metro East area in particular, it became a catastrophic situation.
And so, Early, you mentioned that you didn't see flooding when you first moved there. Could you describe what happens to your home now when it rains?
Well, when it rains now, and the street, the whole backyard, front yard being covered with water. Water on the garage, approximately 2 feet deep. So my garage floor is level with the basement. So anytime that the water gets under the basement, it's a window right by the deck of the back porch. And the basement have to have a window. And so once the water gets under the garage, it just dumps the basement pool.
Yeah. And so what sort of things have been damaged in your home?
When it first started flooding, I lost bedroom, suits, mattress, box spring. Granddaughter had a selection of Michael Jordan tennis and other valuable items. We used to store the Christmas tree down there and other things. And got up one morning and the streets were flooded and all of the debris, the mattress stuff was floating in the basement.
Ugh, sounds awful. So, and so, Nicole, how common are these issues like what Early is describing?
I think what our team had discovered over time as we worked with all the residents was this is more common than not. Mr. Fuse is saying, people were initially using their basements like for common uses, right, for storage purposes. And then as we talked to more residents, that was no more very early on upon purchasing their homes. And then they were losing very basic items like hot water heaters multiple times, repurchasing hot water heaters 4 or 5 times, furnaces 4 or 5 times, things like that. And that's a very common occurrence throughout the families we've talked to. We've talked to and worked with about 54 to 60 families, and that is the common thread, is that hot water heaters, furnaces, flooring, those are all things that have had to be repurchased and redone multiple times over the decades.
And so from the reporting that I've read, it also sounds like there's wastewater and raw sewage and things like that coming up. Have you heard about that? And what are the health concerns for these residents?
Yeah, I mean, sewage, the water, yeah, every, I mean, it's, so it's kind of a unique issue. And by unique, I mean, one resident can have flooding and sewage, and then their next door neighbor might just have flooding, and then the neighbor next door might just have sewage, raw sewage issues. Raw sewage issues are pretty common for the residents throughout Centerville, and it's not just on one side of town. It's their residents come from all over to the meet. They live throughout Centerville. Our team, as well as the residents, are concerned about diseases or what they have been exposed to over time. We are looking into that, but there are so many things that are going on with Centerville that we are trying to piece together and just kind of wrap our arms around what's going on. But we do have, you know, a team of scientists and a team of attorneys and academics like Professor Johnson, who we're just putting our heads together to figure it out. But yeah, the exposure to raw sewage over decades is a concern.
And you don't have to hear about the raw sewage in Centerville. It's you can smell it. I mean, the sewer system backs up. And there are sewer backups that run raw sewage out 24 hours a day, you know, that are just actually pumping raw sewage out into people's yards. And then when you have the floods come, then all that sewage gets spread all around the town.
And so, Professor Johnson, what factors do you think are at play here? Why the issues like this are happening in Centerville and continue to persist?
Well, I think that, I mean, you could look at it on any number of levels. I think that if you listen to the accounts that the residents give, one of the things that they emphasize is that the construction of the interstate highways, particularly the I-255 extension, made things dramatically worse. The infrastructure is clearly not being maintained. I mean, the sewer system backs up all the way. You know, as far as anybody's been able to trace, the sewer system is backing up. The stormwater infrastructure is deteriorated on the face of it. So in the front of people's houses, there's stormwater ditches, but they just have standing water. There's algae growing in them. They're turning into small little meadows. The emergency pumping system, you know, you can look at the pumps and they look like nobody's got in there and worked on them for years. And so I think there's a failure at the local and federal levels, but also at the state level. I mean, that this particular series of disasters in which people like Mr. Fuse, I mean, you could ask him, but if we just guess, I mean, he must have lived through, you know, 40 floods. But somehow by the legal definition of disaster in the state of Illinois, living through 40 floods doesn't count if the floods are of short duration.
Right.
So if you have 40 sewage floods over 20 years or over 8 years or whatever, then that doesn't count as a disaster. And so there's a set of bureaucratic or legalistic ways that people are avoiding taking responsibility for this that to me, taken all together, actually are a form of violence. There's a form of violent neglect that is occurring in Centerville, a form of violent sort of blame shifting.
And it sort of seems like it's a slow unfolding disaster, as you're saying. It's been going on for years and years. And early through all these years, what has been your experience with trying to contact these local public agencies for help?
Well, each time I talk to them, I'll call them, they'll send somebody out and take some pictures, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, and Nicole, I know you've been, it sounds like you've been in touch with these different agencies as well. Has that been your experience, too, that they just send somebody out to take some photos and then move on?
I mean, generally speaking, yes. I mean, our team, we have, you know, we've done FOIA requests. We've had conversations with some of the agencies, and when we press them for answers as to why they haven't intervened and issued violation notices to the city of Centerville or township of Centerville, that's what we get. We say, hey, we know that you've got citizens who've complained, and they're like, yeah, well, we send them a letter, and we ask why no follow-up, and they say, well, we send them a letter, and we assume they've taken care of it. So yeah, Mr. Fuse is right. They lack follow-through and follow-up, and we don't know why. We can surmise several reasons why, right? For all intents and purposes, they have minimally neglected this community, but surely it looks very deliberate.
And so I should note that the 21st did reach out for statements from Common Fields of Cahokia, which is one of the sewer companies or wastewater companies there, maintains most of Centerville's pumps and sewer lines, and the mayor of Centerville's office as well. And we did not hear back from them in time for air here. But Nicole, from what I understand, Senator Duckworth's office has recently become involved in assessing the problem. And what impact has that had?
They've been amazing since the time that they've got involved. They have been meeting with these different agencies. They're agencies that our team has, you know, been involved with, had conversations with. And while some of these agencies were, you know, kind of willing to come to the table with us, once Senator Duckworth's office got involved and has intervened, they've been more willing to, you know, have more substantive action, right, and more accountability. And so they have been great with talking to the IEPA, the EPA, HUD, and really in St. Clair County, and just kind of demanding more action and pushing back on the answers that they're giving. So they've been great. And it's also given the residents, I think, from the feedback that they've given us, some hope, right, that there's going to be some action from them and follow through.
And so early, the St. Louis Dispatch and the Belleville News Democrat, they've both recently published stories about the raw sewage problems in Centerville. How are you feeling about this new attention towards your town? Oh, you still there, Early?
Yes.
What do you think about the new attention to the problems that you're having in Centerville?
Well, I'm hopefully that it'll get to the governor, and maybe somebody in the governor's office will send somebody out to investigate and see the problems that we're having.
Yeah, that you'll get some resolution, it sounds like. And so, Professor Johnson, you've spent some time in this town. How would you describe your experience speaking with residents?
Well, it's very difficult to put into words. The residents of Centerville are some of the most inspiring people I've ever met. In a way, they're absolutely unbowed by this situation, and are, I think, have fought for a long time and are hopefully finally getting some traction. And so for me, as it's been an education in a couple of things. It's been it is eye-opening to see what's happening in Centerville. It's the sort of thing that a lot of our society is set up to allow people like me to avoid seeing. And so that's eye-opening and depressing. But it's also inspiring to meet people who are completely implacable, who are proud and brave, and are mutually supportive in ways that are seldom seen, in the, at least in the, you know, the world that I walk in. People who come together and help one another out and care deeply about one another. And I would include Nicole and the other people who have worked on this in St. Louis. It's really both intellectually exciting and personally inspiring for me to see the work that people are doing.
And so, Nicole, what are the next steps in addressing and solving the problems in Centerville?
I think we just, you know, keep doing what we've been doing. I mean, from day one, myself and my partner in this, Kalila Jackson, she's the other attorney. We are, you know, kind of leading this together. And from day one, our goal is to hold the entities accountable for this, right? Like the citizens of Centerville, they deserve, like, basic things like a functioning sewer system and stormwater system. When, you know, the resident who initially came to me, Walter Berg, we were very much on the same page that if that includes litigation, then so be it. And so our team is on the same page regarding that. And so we still continue down that path in pursuing legal action. Our team is still working on that. while also looking at how we can look at how policy can change. Like Professor Johnson mentioned, there's policies that aren't working on behalf of the residents that really
I'm going to have to stop you there, Nicole. Thank you so much. So it sounds like policy and potential legal services. That's Nicole Nelson, director and founder of Equity Legal Services. We were also joined by Early Fuse, a resident of Centerville, and Walter Johnson, a professor at Harvard University. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Mary Hansen. Over the past few years, efforts have been gathering steam to get the Springfield 1908 race riot site recognized as a national monument. The riot, which some call a massacre, led to the founding of the NAACP. Advocates are also pushing for the Julius Rosenwald House, which is in the Lincoln Home National Historic Site, to become part of a group of national historic sites. Rosenwald was a Jewish philanthropist who funded thousands of schools for African-American children in the segregated South. These efforts are a step in the right direction, but what would historians and advocates like to see done to recognize Black history in Springfield? For more on this, I'm joined on the line now by Catherine Harris, who's the president of the Abraham Lincoln Association. Teresa Haley is also with us from Springfield. She is the president of the Illinois chapter of the NAACP. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Catherine, I want to start with you. Can you tell us more about who Julius Rosenwald was and why he's an important figure in Illinois history?
Well, Julius Rosenwald was born here in Springfield in the Lincoln neighborhood in 1862. He grew up and spent his boyhood years here. However, we know him as the as one of the founders of Sears and Roebuck and the catalog that we all used to call the Wish Book growing up. And he made his mark, however, due to his philanthropy, certainly being the president of Sears and Roebuck. He became very wealthy, and he made his mark in American history through his philanthropy, through the construction and helping to build nearly 5,000 schools in the segregated South.
And so how was Rosenwald influenced by Lincoln?
I think that that influence came because of the qualities that because of the qualities that Mr. Lincoln has, one of which, and for sure, in my opinion, was the idea, the thought that everyone had the ability to rise. And he felt that if Negroes, that's the term that was in use at the time, had the ability to rise, that they would, the conditions would improve, and he found the ability to rise through education. It's ironic that Mr. Lincoln, his education in total would have maybe amounted to maybe the third grade, but he became probably the most significant, one of the most significant persons in American history, despite all of the hardships that he had in his life. Mr. Rosenwald was a man in the who became a man who lived in the lap of luxury, but he gave back. He gave back so that others could achieve their own degree of greatness.
And so I understand there are efforts underway to establish a national park in his honor. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
That is a, in fact, it's a, would be a three, what would you call it, a three-pronged effort, with a part being here in the Lincoln neighborhood, which is already a National Historic Site. And so his home, which is currently administrative offices for the National Park Service, and there would be a portion of that in Chicago and a portion also out on the East Coast where there is, the National Trust for Historic Preservation would be involved as well. So those three areas would help to make and bring Julius Rosenwald recognition.
And so there's a bill in Congress right now to study the possibility of those national historic sites. And there's also a bill to look at establishing the 1908 Race Riot site as a national monument as well. And Teresa, I want to talk a little bit about the Race Riot site with you. Can you remind us a little bit of the history of the site?
Well, in 1908, there was a race riot here in Springfield, Illinois, that led to the establishment of the NAACP. A white woman lied and said that she was raped and identified black gentlemen as the rapist. Later, she recanted her story and said that's not what happened. So that's what led to the start of the race riot in the NAACP. Several homes were burnt. Several people lost their lives because someone lied. So it was a serious issue.
And so, Catherine, can you talk a little bit about the significance of being able to see, as Teresa mentioned, there's these archaeological remnants of the of these burned out homes in Springfield. What's the significance of being able to see them versus just, you know, sort of hearing about them or reading about them?
I'm going to answer this in kind of a curious way. One of the things that I do is I do a first-person presentation of Harriet Tubman, and I've had people tell me that once they have seen that presentation, they tend to remember more about her, and from my helping her to become alive. And I think that seeing the remnants, the archaeological remains of the race riot that happened here in Springfield, I think that will make a significant impression on people, more so than just reading it in a book or hearing people talk about it. So I think the visual part of it truly makes it come alive. It kind of transports you back in your mind to imagine what it might have been like to have experienced that horrible event in our city's history.
And so, Teresa, there are efforts to make this recognized as a national monument. What sort of difference would it make to have it recognized on that scale, and why should it be nationally recognized?
It should be nationally recognized because it's a part of our history. The NAACP is the oldest civil rights organization in the world. We've been around here in Springfield as a result of the race riot 112 years, so that's significant in itself. And just the fact that when they were doing the additional archaeological dig, that they discovered five additional houses. When you go to the Library of Congress or you go to Washington, D.C. to the African American History Museum, there are pictures and there are stories that talk about the race riot, but there are no artifacts. So to have something tangible on board for people to see, read, and explore brings that vision to life as well. So we're excited about the fact that getting this not only on the registry, but making this a reality for all of us. And we in the NAACP, yeah, it was called a race riot because of the time, but we truly see it not as a massacre, but we see it as a terrorist attack. Just think about it. Innocent people are in their homes and in their businesses, snatched out of their homes, shot and hung in trees. That is a terrorist attack when somebody is attacked without any type of warning, not a massacre.
And so, Catherine, sort of thinking about that that history, how do you think about weaving that together with the conversation about Lincoln and with the history of Lincoln and in his hometown of Springfield?
Well, I think that Mr. Lincoln would be very embarrassed that this happened in his own hometown, and I think that is what makes the story of the race riot all the more memorable, because it happened right here in the home of the, quote, great emancipator. But much as Teresa has said, it was indeed a terrorist attack up on us. And I think that anytime you can draw attention to that event, and if attention is drawn through the creation of a national park, I think that just raises the significance and the importance of the story to not only Springfield and Illinois history, but much as Teresa has said, national history, because the NAACP is indeed the oldest, the baddest, and the most respected civil rights organization in certainly in the United States, if not indeed around the world, because people have patterned activities that they do around the world after events and actions that the NAA has taken in order to bring about change.
And so, Teresa, I think one of the when you come to Springfield, it's a lot about Lincoln. There's the history, there's the historic site, there's the presidential library and museum. But do you think that the conversation should be about more than Lincoln? Should we be having conversations and highlighting history beyond Lincoln?
I do believe that that should take place, and it's already starting to take place, because on Abraham Lincoln's ground site, we have the Race Riot Monument. We actually have two statues sitting right across the street from the Presidential Museum and Library. So that is a start. We also have banners hanging downtown Springfield. When people came in for the last governor's inauguration and everything was shut down because of what was happening in D.C., I started personally telling people about our rich history here in Springfield. And you would be amazed that people who live right here in Springfield don't even know our history. People who came from Chicago for their fifth grade or eighth grade school trips, field trips, aren't aware of the history of the NAACP, because it was that history that no one wanted to talk about because of the shame and embarrassment. But it's our history, and if we don't talk about it, we're bound to repeat it.
And so at the end of last year, we had on Stacey Grundy on our program. She's the vice president of the Root History Museum and Shop in Springfield. And I just want to play a clip from our conversation with her.
Springfield is known for Abraham Lincoln and, you know, and more recently the race riots. But it has such a rich history of the people, the everyday people who lived and walked the streets. And so that's kind of what Root History tries to do. We try to bring out those stories of those everyday people so that the children, you know, children and adults and everyone can see this is the history of your community. And so this is the legacy that was laid before you.
That was Stacey Grundy from the Root History Museum in Springfield. Teresa, what's your reaction to what she's saying? Do you agree that we need to be putting more emphasis on the individual stories as well as the ones that we've already been discussing?
I think we need to focus on all of it. All of it is a part of our history. But if you don't know your past, you're bound to repeat it. So I think the NAACP and the race riot that led to the establishment of the NAACP is a great start for all of us. And then you can add in that other history because, yes, Black folks migrated to Springfield from the Great South and have done great things, but a lot of folks who left Springfield after the race riot. So I think it's important for us to share all parts of our history.
And what do you think, Catherine?
Oh, I certainly agree with her, because we need to tell the story of our city, and oftentimes the story from in reference to the NAACP and the African Americans is not told. But we have to tell the story, warts and all. And even though the race riot could be considered a wart, there was good to come out of it, which was indeed the founding of the NAACP.
And
May I add something?
Sure.
I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate Teresa Haley as being recognized by the NAACP with the Image Award for being an activist. Because I think her work has helped draw attention to Springfield, our role in history, and many of the steps that we have made forward, not only as her being our local president, but also our state president as well. And I'd just like to congratulate you, Teresa, on that.
A very warm congratulations to you, Teresa. Thank you both so much for joining us. Catherine Harris is the president of the Abraham Lincoln Association in Springfield. We also spoke with Teresa Haley, who's the president of the Illinois chapter of the NAACP. Thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can follow the 21st on Twitter, search 21st Show. We also live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. All of the links from the stories and things that we've covered, and every other way to contact us. If you would like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Julian Haida. Eunice Alpashot is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for their theme music. I'm Mary Hansen. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.